The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bryan, Judge Sarah Wheelock, Judge John Smith, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. This case is A211083 in the matter of the welfare of KAH.
Good morning. Welcome. And I want to start with some reminders and some words of thanks. First of all, thank you for being willing to participate with us remotely this morning. And we are not in the MJC, but the same rules would apply. Secondly, I want to make sure that you all know where to look. There is a clock that should be, if you're in gallery view, you should be able to see that clock just fine and know how much time is remaining. Sometimes people switch off into the active speaker view, and then they might not be able to see it because it gets really small. So make sure you're able to see the clock. I also want to remind you, when you're not speaking, to mute yourselves. And when you begin your arguments, to state your name and the party you represent for the record, because these are being recorded. The audio will be recorded. We also understand that from time to time, there may be technical difficulties or interruptions, doorbells, pets, that sort of thing. We'll do our best to keep that to a minimum, but we do understand that that can happen, and we will try to accommodate any issues that we have to make sure you get all the time to which you're entitled to present your arguments to us. And with that, Mr. Lau, are you prepared to proceed?
I am. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, go ahead.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Chang Lau. I am an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, KAH. Now, the state charged appellant with two homicide offenses by petition in this case and moved to certify him for adult certification. Certification was presumed. To rebut the presumption, appellant and his counsel had to prove by clear convincing evidence that it was in the interest of public safety to keep appellant's proceedings in juvenile court. Despite possessing that burden of proof, counsel at the start of appellant's certification hearing rested without presenting any arguments, testimony, or other evidence. In his closing argument, counsel did not apply the six public safety factors under section 260B.125 to the facts of this case, or argue that any of the factors weighed in favor of designating appellant in extended jurisdiction juvenile. Counsel further failed to recognize in his closing argument that he possessed the burden of proof and not the state. Rather, counsel copied word for word several facts from the psychological evaluation and summarily asked the court to deny certification without providing any legal basis. Under these circumstances, trial counsel's performance was so deficient, it altogether failed to put the state's case to meaningful adversarial testing. Appellant is entitled to a new certification hearing with competent counsel. Now, alternatively, if this court decides the two-pronged Strickland test applies to this case, appellant asks this court to remand for an evidentiary hearing to allow him to prove his trial counsel was ineffective under that test. Now, at the outset, I want to make clear what we are not arguing. What we are not arguing is that appellant's counsel below should have made different arguments or take a different tactic in defending against certification. Instead, we are arguing that counsel did not make any meaningful, substantive effort to rebut the presumption of certification. That is, counsel did not provide any evidence or argument in an effort to prove it was in the interest of public safety to keep appellant's proceedings in juvenile court. Under these circumstances, counsel's performance altogether failed to subject the state's case to meaningful adversarial testing. And because this is a structural error test, prejudice is presumed, and the case must be remanded for new certification hearing.
Mr. Lau, if I could follow up on something you said earlier. As I reviewed your brief, I did not see any alternative argument applying Strickland. And in fact, the brief, pages 14 to 15, argue that it's impossible to apply Strickland. So as I review the brief, I see only one issue before the court, right? There's two types. You've got your Strickland standard, and you have what I think of as chronic number two, right? There are those three examples. So I really, as I review your brief, I think you've only argued chronic number two. I don't see anywhere in your brief where you're making this alternative argument under Strickland.
Right. And so it is our position that the chronic standard, which is a modified Strickland test, is the one that applies to this case, right? And all, at the end of the day, we're trying to figure out whether or not counsel was ineffective. And the two tests require different showings.
Well, I think there's some differences as well. Obviously, there's a difference regarding prejudice, right? When you're presuming it in one case, but you have to prove it in the other. But I think there's also a difference, and it's not merely one of degree, because Strickland requires a comparison, and chronic does not. Chronic is simply, is there any effort, really? Because entirely fail is the standard. So if there's any effort, then that would meet the standard in chronic. So that seems to me to be pretty different from Strickland. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that, Your Honor. My only purpose in arguing the alternative request for relief is that historically, this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have applied the Strickland test when they've determined that the chronic test does not apply.
Well, that's when those parties argued both, right? If an appellant argues that alternative, then it's presented to the court. But I don't think that's happened here. So I think we're only on the one issue of chronic number two.
Sure. I mean, I don't know what was argued in those cases, I guess. I can't remember in Dejere or in Dahlbeck that the alternative was argued. I just know that in those cases, the Strickland tests were applied after the court determined that the chronic test did not. My whole point is that if the court is not inclined to grant a new certification hearing under chronic, that it has this alternative means to ensure that my client's right to effective counsel are vindicated, right? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, defense counsel here below didn't do an adequate job. And whether or not you want to say it was altogether lacking or it was deficient under Strickland, you know, we should be given the opportunity to figure that out. And my argument in the brief as to why the chronic test is so applicable in juvenile cases is because there's not truly a mechanism by which we can determine through supplemental evidence that the attorney was in fact deficient under the Strickland test, or that my client was prejudiced by that deficient performance. I do think they are different tests, but I think if the court finds that there was something wrong here under the juvenile rules and under the civil appellate rules, there is a mechanism by which the court, in the interest of justice, can remand the case for an evidentiary hearing.
Well, let's put aside the whether Strickland is preserved or argued. I shouldn't say preserved, but whether it's presented to us. It strikes me that there might be some differences between the factual findings of factual guilt or innocence that might occur at a trial versus application of the six public safety factors. Do you see any differences, and what does that mean for purposes of applying chronic number two? In other words, when you have witnesses that are typically presenting testimony, whether it's expert witness or it's, say, a warden or somebody familiar with what programming is available at a particular facility, many times an evaluator, for example, they're giving testimony that supports both sides' position as they might argue how those six public safety factors are weighed. And you're not really presenting evidence that is directly addressing factual innocence or guilt. So do you think that there are differences, and do those differences change what is adversarial testing?
I think at the end of the, I mean, yeah, there are differences in determining guilt and determining whether or not these public safety factors favor certification or not. But at the end of the day, what the burden is on the child is a clear and convincing level of proof that keeping the child in the juvenile courts is in the interest of public safety. So at the end of the day, you still have this standard of proof that needs to be met. And, you know, in order to do that, you need to present evidence, point to the record, and make arguments. And none of that was done. I mean,
if there were a witness, and say an evaluator, who's going to be testifying, and there are some favorable things that evaluator might say, or someone who would testify to the fact that a juvenile has no prior history, criminal history. If that's a witness that the state calls, you wouldn't necessarily conclude that the defense counsel is ineffective or falling below the chronic number two standard by not calling a witness if the state's witness would readily admit facts that would support their argument regarding those factors. That's why I wonder if it affects what we think of as adversarial in a way, because the witnesses, presenting witnesses, calling witnesses, that's not really an expectation we might have.
Well, you wouldn't have that expectation if the burden weren't on my client, right? As a defense attorney in a trial, I can make the tactical decision not to call any witnesses. I can make the decision not to call my client to the stand and just poke holes in the state's case and say, look, it's their burden to prove by beyond a reasonable doubt that my client is guilty, and they failed to do that. Now, here, it's different because the burden is on my client and his counsel to prove by clear and convincing evidence that keeping the case in the juvenile courts is the right thing to do. And by simply resting at the start of the certification hearing, the state could have chosen to do nothing at that point. The state could have chosen to not call any witnesses at that point, and a defense attorney would have not been able to reference anything other than the reports, and then the court would have found that there was not enough evidence presented because there would literally have been no evidence presented.
And that kind of gets to the heart of my question, because if chronic number two is asking us to consider the efforts made to subject the state to adversarial testing, implicit in that is an understanding that the defense attorney does not have a burden, but rather it's the efforts to rebut or to combat what the state's burden. So that's getting to the heart of my question, that chronic number two has some implicit understanding about what adversarial means that doesn't necessarily apply in the context of a certification hearing.
Well, I mean, I would ask Your Honor to consider the fact that it is ultimately the state who is moving to certify my client, right? Ultimately, it is the state that's filing the motion to certify. And you know, under different circumstances, it would be the state's factual circumstances. It would be the state's burden to prove that certification is warranted in a particular case. But ultimately, it is the state's certification. And because my client was a certain age when the alleged acts were committed, because, you know, of the presumptive adult sentence, if there was conviction, the burden was on him and his attorney. And I think at the end of the day, what you need to do is still fight that motion by the state and put that to adversarial testing, regardless of whose burden it is. I do think that can still be considered adversarial testing. Now, before the time runs out, I'd like to address the state's point about whether or not my client had an opportunity to bring these arguments to the district court, either before or as this appeal was pending. The answer is no. Under the state argues that appellant could have moved to stay certification, and the district court could have granted that. It's discretionary. And bring a motion under Rule 16, which allows for a post-trial motion to have the court reconsider its trial findings under Rule 13.09. The court makes a, or the state makes a vague reference in a footnote that the rule extends beyond motions that are post-trial, but then does not cite to any authority to support that. It's fairly clear from the plain reading of Rule 16 that the motion must be brought within 15 days of trial. And here we don't have a trial. We have a certification hearing, and there were no trial findings under Rule 13.09. So the time limit never starts under Rule 16. Now, as far as the state's argument that appellant can wait until after he goes through the adult proceedings in the adult criminal court and challenge certification there under Powell. One, I will just note that Powell doesn't squarely address whether or not that's allowed under 590. And the second thing I will say is that given the courts and the rules recognize that, you know, these matters should be resolved on an expedited basis, it would be unfair to require that my client wait in jail and prison for that long before he can challenge any certification determinations. So for all those reasons, I would ask this court to reverse the district court certification order and grant my client a new certification hearing with competent counsel. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lau. Now, Mr. Schmidt, go ahead.
Good morning, and may it please the court. John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. This court should affirm because on this record, appellant cannot establish that counsel's performance was ineffective. The parties clearly have a disagreement as to whether Strickland or Chronic number two applies, and the state believes that Strickland is the correct standard. Chronic is inapplicable here because it has to be the equivalent of a sleeping attorney, which was simply not the case here. Looking at appellant's brief on pages 13 through 15, the reason appellant argued Chronic number two applies was because it was according to appellant, impossible to prove the outcome would have been different, but for counsel's errors. And that goes to the last points that counsel was just making. It wasn't argued about that. That was the whole purpose of why they should, why the court should apply the Chronic number two standard, that there's no possible remedy for the juvenile to prove the prejudice of the Strickland.
Mr. Schmidt, standard. Let me just jump in because I don't see that the, let's say it's a criminal trial and you have a sleeping attorney. The ineffective assistance argument is still one that could have been presented, but instead a defense attorney might want to seek review under Chronic number two. Are you saying that when a court determines that the defense attorney's or an attorney's conduct is defense attorney entirely fails to subject the state to adversarial testing, that they are precluded from applying Strickland?
Not at all. I think appellant could have argued in the alternative, said that Chronic number two applies because it was counsel's performance was so ineffective that it amounts to a structural error. But alternatively, Strickland applies, which then you get to the prejudice prong. That wasn't argued in appellant's brief. Now, as respondent, we did argue Strickland applies, and I understand why counsel is arguing now today and to rebut the Strickland argument that I made. Certainly not precluded from arguing in the alternative. What I am arguing here is that Chronic doesn't apply because it does not amount to the so ineffective that amounts to structural error. And I'm trying to focus.
Well, but I guess whether something applies is different than whether the standard is met, right? So to say Chronic doesn't apply because there were efforts made in this case to put the state to adversarial testing, that sounds like what you're arguing is that the standard in Chronic is satisfied, that the attorney's efforts didn't fall below the standard in Chronic. That's different than saying it doesn't apply.
Very fair. And it's just the words that I'm using should be more specific. Chronic can apply, but the standard here was not met because counsel did not amount to the sleeping attorney. standard, the such a high burden that is necessary under that factor. In getting to the Strickland analysis, there certainly are opportunities. And the whole reason, again, that appellant argued that chronic number two applies is because they don't have the opportunity to do a post-conviction petition in this case. But as I tried to point out, there are opportunities for which to, at a minimum, make an offer of proof to show what would have been presented. To make that Strickland number two prong, to meet that standard. You can do a Rule 18 motion to reconsider. You can, under Rule 16, if you considered the certification a trial, you can move for a new trial. There is the post-conviction that's available. But at a minimum, there's an offer of proof that can be made in order to satisfy that second prong. So number one, chronic number two, that standard isn't met. Number two, I do think, although it can be argued that it applies in this case, certainly, but what I'm saying is the reason behind appellant's argument of why it applies is not applicable here. And it's not applicable because there are alternatives to meet that Strickland prong. Now, getting into the prejudice itself, part of the problem is that it's impossible in this case, given the facts of this crime and the age of this juvenile, to be able to change any facts here. The when you go through the various factors, factor one, the seriousness of the offense, the juvenile here was charged with aiding and abetting second degree murder and aiding and abetted attempted second degree murder. The crime was on video. There's nothing that an attorney can do to try to poke holes in the seriousness of the crime, especially given that the petition that's being certified must be taken as true and it's on video. No attorney, no matter if you have the best counsel in the world, you can't change the facts that exist there.
So wouldn't it the opposite be true too, though? If you have a sleeping attorney, it wouldn't matter.
It yes. I mean, if you are in the chronic factor, yes, it wouldn't matter. If you have an attorney who just does absolutely nothing and falls asleep the entire time, does not ask any questions, does not show up for hearings, does not file a written closing argument, which are things that did happen here, yeah, it wouldn't matter. It would be structural error. And so under chronic number two, that's correct. But in the prejudice factors of Strickland, which again, the state argues should be applied here, and it should not adopt at least the way I read pages 13 through 15 of appellant's brief, they were asking for a structural error analysis for all juvenile certification hearings because juveniles don't have the opportunity to prove prejudice.
And that's how I read those pages as well. Like there has to be a way to review the effectiveness of certification counsel.
Right. And that's how I read that. And I think there is a way to review that in either that's an offer of proof, that's a motion to reconsider. There's a number of different ways that you can put some evidence before the juvenile court to establish that prejudice prong. But the prejudice prong here, if we're in the Strickland world, we're outside of chronic two and we're in Strickland, the prejudice prong here simply can't change the facts that exist in this case, which show the crime was extremely serious. The culpability, again, this is on camera, the culpability, which is factor two, that can't change. The fact that appellant's criminal history, factor three, was increasingly serious. And most importantly, as to factors five and six, you can't change the appellant's age here. The court took great lengths in its order to say the appellant is 19 years old and the time in the juvenile system is extremely limited and found those factors in favor of certification. So when you take factors one and three, the most important factors, which facts, no facts would change that, no matter what would be presented. You add that to factors two, five, and six, certification, no matter what was presented, is going to happen in this case, and prejudice would not be able to be proven. The final note is that there certainly are availabilities to test that prejudice piece, and counsel's argument today for remand for an evidentiary hearing, I think shows just that, because there isn't, that doesn't necessarily exist in the juvenile proceeding. But if you do a motion to reconsider and say, judge, on the juvenile court, please let us do a motion to reconsider. Here is what we are going to present to you on an ineffective assistance claim. Please give us an evidentiary hearing. The judge can either deny that, and then at that point you have an appeal about whether an evidentiary hearing should have occurred, or the judge would grant the evidentiary hearing, and then you have, at a minimum, you have an offer of proof, and at best you have an evidentiary hearing where you can test the second Strickland prong. Unless the court has any questions, we would ask that you affirm the certification order in this case and remand for proceedings in an adult court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lau, rebuttal?
Yeah. The first thing I want to address is something I'm a little bit confused about what opposing counsel is talking about with regards to a Rule 18 motion for reconsideration. Nothing exists of that nature. Now, as far as a Rule 16 motion for reconsideration, again, that has to do with post-trial reconsideration. As I mentioned before, this is not a trial context we're talking about here. We're talking about certification hearing. That rule does not allow for reconsideration. Now, even if somehow this court can read that rule to allow for recertification, even though it specifically addresses Rule 13.09 findings, when those are made, that's when the 15-day timeline begins. And Rule 13.09 specifically talks about trial findings and the verdict. So we're talking specifically about the trial, but even if this court reads that to somehow broadly include certification hearings, there's only 15 days following the certification hearing to make that motion. So either I haven't received a file at that point to make any of these motions. So either the counsel is suggesting that my client, a juvenile, would make that ineffective assistance to counsel claim on his own, or the claim would be made by the attorney who is claimed to be ineffective. That attorney would lodge such a claim against himself. I mean, for various reasons, that interpretation of that rule is absurd. There is no mechanism by which pre-appeal, my client could legitimately, truly file a request for an evidentiary hearing to litigate a Strickland claim. Now, as far as just to clarify the reason why I included that language about the difficulty in which to prove ineffective assistance of counsel in juvenile court, my position wasn't that in all IAC claims, this court should apply the chronic two test. My point is that the chronic two test should apply to situations as my clients, because I do believe that the attorney below was that deficient, that it that relief should be granted under chronic two. And second, structural error tests are generally applied in cases where it's difficult to determine prejudice. And I point out the difficulty in getting an evidentiary hearing to point out that point. So again, I'm not saying in all circumstances where a juvenile client in the certification context files an ineffective claim that the chronic two test should be applied. My point is just that it should be applicable in this context too. Now, as far as whether or not counsel, did enough or did anything at all, I understand that he asked seven questions of the state's witnesses. One of those questions was to determine whether or not he was familiar with the witness from past encounters. I understand that he filed the closing argument, but he didn't apply any of the six factors to the facts of the case. He relies on the state's evidence to say without legal bases that my client should not be certified. He doesn't acknowledge the fact that he has the burden of proof in this closing argument. He copy and pastes from the psychological report, doesn't make his own arguments. He can't type the facts that are actually in the record into his closing argument. In that circumstance, regardless of whether or not he's just going through the simple motions or doing nothing, the outcome is the same. There is no actual meaningful effort, substantive effort, to try to keep my client from being certified. And given the burden was on him to do that, I think, you know, this court has to find that, you know, there was no meaningful adversarial testing here. And so for all of those reasons, I'd ask that this court hold that counsel was deficient and my client is entitled to a new certification prayer. Thank you.
I want to thank both attorneys for their arguments, both written and their oral arguments today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.